From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. It is Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This means we will get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our region this week. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richert, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with BoiseDev.com, and Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, as well as Wyoming Public Media. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday,
Gemma.
Happy Friday.
So, Clark, let's get up to date on a one particular new law that took effect on July 1st here in Idaho. But, Clark, it's already being challenged legally by the League of Women Voters and Babe Vote. So what's going on here?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Gemma. Thanks. This is House Bill 340. It's a new voter registration law that the Idaho legislature passed earlier this year during the 2023 legislative session. And just as you mentioned, it's been challenged by a Boise-based young voter advocacy group called Babe Vote, and also the League of Women Voters. And they filed a motion in Ada County District Court asking a judge to block the implementation of this law. They've said that it makes it really, really difficult to register people to vote if they don't have a current Idaho driver's license. And I can kind of get into what the law does and where it came from. But I talked to Secretary of State Phil McGrane, who's the one who sponsored the law. And he said what the point of the law is to standardize the ID requirements and the procedures for registering to vote, no matter which way you register to vote. And so what they're doing is they're taking the requirements that had been in place in Idaho law for when you do same-day voter registration on election day at your polling place. That requires you to prove both your identity and your residency. And so now they're saying, we're going to take those procedures and we're going to apply that to all forms of voter registration, including folks who register to vote online and including folks who fill out a voter registration card. You know, maybe you're out at a summer event or a fair or a festival and there's a voter registration drive going on. And they may ask you to fill out a card and turn that in. And so what they're doing is this new law makes you prove both identity and residency, no matter what type of voter registration you sign up for. And so the group Babe Vote is kind of leading the charge against this new law. They said that they were able to register hundreds of new voters across Idaho in the month of June, but have had a really hard time registering people since this new law took effect July 1. And basically they're saying that there's a follow-up piece. So let's say we're out at a 4th of July celebration and someone comes up to us with voter registration cards and we want to get registered, but we don't have an Idaho driver's license with us, or maybe we've moved and we didn't update our address with the state of Idaho. So even if you fill out that voter registration card and send it in, you won't be able to be issued a ballot. You won't be able to vote until you follow up and provide those proof of residency documents. There's a couple of different ways that you can do that. You can go to your local county court's county clerk's office at the county courthouse and present the documents there. You can update your address online with the state of Idaho if you have an Idaho driver's license but the address was just out of date, or you can just wait till election day and you can do it when you show up to your polling place to vote on election day. I've got a list of the documents in our article at the Idaho Capital Sun that just came out this morning, but I've got a list of all the different documents that you can use. The easiest one for folks who are in a position where they have a current Idaho driver's license with their current address, that's going to be the easiest because that one driver's license will satisfy both requirements to prove your identity and your residency. But that's not everybody. Not everybody, as you know, has an Idaho driver's license. And so it gets a little bit more complicated and confusing, is what the people challenging this law have said, for folks that don't have their driver's license. They were also worried that the law creates some confusion, that maybe you remember being out at the 4th of July celebration and filling out the voter registration card, but you didn't realize you needed to follow up and that you aren't going to be able to vote until you provide those forms of documentation. Mm-hmm. And I did talk to the county clerk in Bonneville County, and I talked to Secretary of State Phil McGrane, like I said, and they said in those instances, when there are new voters who come into the system and they register, whether it's online or turning in the registration card, they're going to get a letter in the mail letting them know what they need to do, that they need to follow up to provide that proof of residency. But right now, mm-hmm. Like you said, there's a challenge in Ada County. I think the next hearing is going to be next Friday on this. So this law is in effect right now. It's the law of Idaho, but it is being challenged. And I guess one other thing that I want to point out, if you're already registered to vote and if you haven't changed your address, you don't need to do anything to comply with this new law. It's really for folks who are registering new for the first time, mm-hmm. or updating their registration. And really where it comes into play, the differences, like I said, are the differences with people registering online or filling out that voter registration card out at a summer event, because the requirements had already been in place if you register in person at your polling place, that you need to provide those documents. So a couple of things to keep in mind. I do have a list of all the different documents that are accepted at our story at the Idaho Capital Sun. And I'll continue to follow the court hearing and these challenges and let folks know what they need to keep in mind, because I know we have elections coming up, depending on where mm-hmm. you live, this summer. And we have city elections coming up in November that a lot of people are going to be interested in. So I'll continue to follow it, and I'll let people know what the latest is. But if you're already registered, if you haven't moved, you don't need to do anything. You don't need to change anything. This is really for new voter registration and folks who are needing to update their registration.
Okay. And of course, we'll have you on, Clark, to keep us updated here as well.
Sounds great.
Kevin, the University of Idaho's acquisition of the University of Phoenix is being challenged by Idaho's Attorney General. You recently wrote an opinion piece on this, saying that the lawsuit's getting fairly interesting. But in particular, if we look ahead to the next gubernatorial election.
Yeah, I love to speculate about politics. I mean, politics is you know, if you can't wildly and prematurely speculate about politics, you're doing it wrong. Obviously, there's a lot of history here between Attorney General Raul Labrador and Governor Brad Little. I mean, you go mm-hmm. back to the 2018 primary, one of the most expensive and maybe one of the most contentious primaries we've ever seen in this state. I think a lot of folks are watching this lawsuit and watching, you know, Raul Labrador's first few months in office in general, and looking at to what extent is he positioning himself for another run for governor. And whether he runs or not is one part of the equation. Whether Brad Little decides to run for a third term, that's another big consideration. He will be 72 years old in the year 2026. So who knows who's going to be running? But the politics of this whole lawsuit over the University of Phoenix, the politics is really interesting, because I think it really mm-hmm. gets at something much larger that's going on right now in the moment. This whole purchase of the University of Phoenix has really created a lot of fault lines within Idaho political and education circles. You've got the state board, and you've got the University of Idaho's administration anyway, and to some degree, Governor Little. He's not been talking very much about the purchase, but he's on board with the purchase. You've got those folks on one side of this debate, and you've got quite a few people on the other side of the debate. You've got a number of legislators, and Clark was at the hearing that I was at last month when the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee brought University of Idaho President C. Scott Green in, brought him down to Boise for a very unusual out-of-session oversight hearing to talk about the Phoenix purchase. And JFAC members were asking some really pointed questions. So you've got lawmakers who are really skeptical. You've got quite a few folks in the university community who are skeptical about this whole thing. Idaho Statesman had a really good story about that last week. So you've got all of these political and education fault lines over this purchase. And the lawsuit really gets at it. If you read Raul Labrador's lawsuit, it's pretty clear that he is extremely skeptical about the wisdom of the purchase of the University of Phoenix. You have to dig through the lawsuit very deeply to find where he really is on this issue. It's, yeah, and we're just kind of getting started with this whole U of I Phoenix purchase issue. There's a lot that has to unfold in the next few months. So this lawsuit, I think, really gets at a lot of those issues.
Okay, so with that said, Kevin, speaking of, you know, having this having a lot of layers, what in the world is going on with this new U and what the University of Idaho basically, I think, getting like a cease and desist from another university? What is what in the world is going on with this?
Yeah, it's like new U. We hardly knew you. New U was the that was the name of the nonprofit that the University of Idaho is creating. The whole purchase of Phoenix is going to be under the umbrella of a nonprofit organization that's separate at the University of Idaho, but it's populated by some high-level administrators from the U of I. When this whole purchase was unveiled back in May, the state board said that the nonprofit was going to be called New U. The state board's meeting packets, their press release all said New U. University of Idaho has said New U. Within 2 weeks, the actual New U, New U University, which was based in Washington, D.C., wrote a letter to the University of Idaho and said, hey, hold on a second, we're New U, and you're horning in on our brand, and by doing that, you're creating confusion with students who might come to our university. Knock it off, and oh, by the way, we'd like $25,000 up front and $25,000 a week for as long as you continue to use the new U brand. U of I did write back a few days later and said, okay, we don't think we infringed on your copyright or anything like that, but we will get rid of the new U name as sort of an olive branch. So that's happened. New U Idaho is now known as 4-3 Education. That's because we're the 43rd state in the union.
Okay.
That's the new name of the nonprofit. So New U in Idaho is no more. Apparently, U of I is not planning to pay any money to New U University. And, you know, it seems like in some ways that issue has kind of petered out, but really kind of an interesting exchange between New U and New U.
Well, and it just shows, I think, Kevin, like just how complicated this has been. And frankly, still how I think everyone was thrown for a loop when this announcement was made about this acquisition, what, back in May?
Right. And I think you got to say that U of I has been a little bit less than upfront about the flap over New U. And they were downright disingenuous in one of their letters to New U University, where they said, well, the only reason this name is even coming out is because of, you know, outside third-party media reports that mentioned New U. Well, the reason New U got into the news was that it was in literally the State Board of Education's news release about this acquisition. It was in the State Board of Education's meeting materials. It was the term that Scott Green, president of the University of Idaho, attached to this nonprofit. You know, we reporters didn't dream up New U out of thin air. It was there, and never was it presented as, oh, this is our working title. We're going to come up with something else. It's a crazy mess, and, you know, just another sidelight in what's becoming a very convoluted story.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's switch gears for a minute, and we'll bring you into the conversation. So many of us here in the Mountain West, well, we're familiar with geothermal. I mean, here in Boise, we have Warm Springs Avenue, which there's a geothermal whole system that runs below it. I mean, we've got Yellowstone. I mean, we know what geothermal is. With that said, though, there are some Western governors now who actually want to use this as an energy source. Can you fill us in on this?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, Boise is kind of the gem when it comes to geothermal. A lot of your downtown is already powered by geothermal, as you just said. It's really critical. And, you know, like The stuff that makes the geysers in Yellowstone and these amazing thermal pools is exactly the same energy that Western governors want to harness here. I want to point out a couple of unique things about this. First of all, the Western Governors Association, you know, it takes politicians from all over the region, which means they're going to be extremely politically diverse. You know, it's not every day that you see Colorado's governor agreeing with Wyoming's governor on something. Geothermal is something where they agree on, and there's tremendous potential for this resource, specifically in the Mountain West, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and Nevada. And essentially, the Western governors are looking for ways to harness that quicker. You know, this means things like permitting reform, a lot of stuff that gets pretty in the weeds when it comes to lawmaking. But the goal is for this to be something that is more useful. Geothermal is pretty clean. It can be really effective. And so, like I said, it's not something that everyone agrees with all the time. There are some problems with geothermal, but at the same time, I think it wouldn't be surprising if in another 10 years, we see more and more geothermal activity in our region.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, it has been 8 months now since the tragic murders of four University of Idaho college students at a home on King Road in Moscow. Now, the University of Idaho was basically given the home. It was going to be demolished. They were going to put some type of memorial there. But then some people said, whoa, whoa, wait, we don't want the house torn down. So what's going on now with this?
Well, basically, Gemma, the demolition is on hold until October. And that October timing is pretty significant because Brian Koberger, the suspect in the quadruple homicide, his first-degree murder trial is scheduled to begin on, I want to say, October 2nd. So the U of I put the demolition on hold, and you're right. There was some pushback about the timing of the demolition and the question of whether the house should remain intact through the trial, because as an attorney for one of the victims' families pointed out, you know, there's evidentiary value in the house itself. Now, the U of I will point and say that neither the prosecution nor the defense objected to the plan to demolish the building, but nonetheless, the demolition is on hold for at least a couple more months.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Kevin. I was talking with some attorneys and judges who are not involved in this case whatsoever, but just talking to them from a legal standpoint of, you know, because I had not thought about this demolition of this home and how it could potentially impede jurors, right? Because in many murder cases, jurors do go on these, you know, I'm putting in quotes, field trips, where they will go to the crime scene and they will walk through where the crimes happened to give them a better understanding, right, of what happened. And so I would assume that that's kind of what the victim's family attorney argued was you could potentially be destroying not just that possibility, but there could be evidence potentially. You don't know.
Right. I mean, and I suppose that that's always possible, but we don't know how that trial is going to unfold in October or whenever the trial takes place. But it's possible the jurors might be might go to the scene of the crimes. And yeah, there are things you can do, I'm sure, to prepare for demolition. And it sounds like that's some of what U of I has been doing is, you know, lead abatement, asbestos abatement, stuff like that. I mean, the jurors aren't going to the house to look at asbestos or lead.
Right.
They're looking to get they would be going to get a sense of the layout of the house and the layout of the house as it relates to the events that unfolded that horrible morning. So I can understand, you know, the argument for trying to keep this home intact, at least until you know how the trial plays out.
Right. Yeah. So we will have to wait and see what happens there. So Clark, we've spoken about this briefly on the show about, you've been on before talking about this proposed open primary ballot initiative. So there was a signature drive going on, right? But that's on hold now because, there's a legal challenge going on. So can you get us up to date on what this proposal is and now why it's in court?
Yeah, for sure. The Idaho Supreme Court is going to be holding a hearing likely next month in August over the legal challenge for this open primary ballot initiative that we have talked about a couple of times before. Like you said, it's a proposed ballot initiative that would do away with the closed party primary system that we have in Idaho, and it would make a couple of changes. It would create a primary election where any candidates and any voters could all participate in the same primary election, regardless of party affiliation. And then the top four vote getters from the primary would advance to the November general election, again, regardless of party affiliation. It would also change the general election to create an instant runoff, what's called ranked choice voting, where of those four candidates who are on the ballot, Idahoans would be able to vote for their favorite candidate. And then on the same ballot, they would have the opportunity, if they want, to rank the other remaining candidates in order of preference. Those are kind of the high level changes that the initiative would do. This was originally cleared by the Secretary of State's office to begin the signature drive a couple of weeks ago, but the supporters of the Open Primary Initiative are challenging something called ballot titles that were assigned by Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador's office. The ballot titles describe what the initiative is and what it does, and those are attached to the petitions, and those kind of describe to the public what the initiative does. The supporters of the Open Primary Ballot Initiative say that the ballot titles supplied by Attorney General Labrador are misleading, and they reflect his personal bias against the initiative, whereas the Attorney General's office, Labrador's office, is standing by the process, saying that they did their job, that they issued these ballot titles that describe the initiative. And oh, by the way, they're going to sue if the initiative ever qualifies for the ballot. So we knew that this was going to be a big legal fight, and here we are. But yeah, the latest is the signature drive is on hold. So they're not out collecting signatures right now while we get this issue with the ballot titles decided. It's kind of one of the last big pieces to get finalized before moving ahead with the signature drive. And so we do expect that Idaho Supreme Court will hold a hearing on this next month in August at some point. Attorney General Labrador's office is already on the clock. I think they have something like 12 more days to provide a written response to the challenge, and then we'll be going to court next month. But timing is an issue. The open primary supporters are hoping to get this on the November 2024 ballots, and they have, as of now, they have until May 1st to collect about 64,000 signatures, and they have to meet two important requirements. They have to get 6% of the registered voters statewide, as well as that percentage of voters in 18 of Idaho's 35 different legislative districts. So timing is an issue. It's a big dispute. It's basically been a dispute from the outset between the Attorney General's office and the open primary supporters. And now we're that much closer to the court date. And the most recent news is this legal challenge was officially filed earlier this week on Monday with the Idaho Supreme Court. But timing's a factor, and we're kind of at odds right now between the initiative supporters and the Attorney General's office. It gets a little bit complicated and into the weeds, but it basically breaks down to the Attorney General's office says this initiative violates Idaho law because it addresses more than one subject. They're saying that it addresses primary elections and general elections, and that's two distinct different subjects. The open primary supporters, including former Idaho Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Jones, they disagree. They say it only addresses one subject, and that subject is elections. And so they're at odds here, and we're going to watch this legal challenge play out. But that's the latest right now, is the signature drive is on hold while we all gear up for a court date that we anticipate will take place next month.
Okay. Gretchen, let me bring you into the conversation. Tell us what's going on with the Simplot company agreeing to pay a pretty significant amount of money. This is in regards to a lawsuit about environmental cleanup.
Yes, that's right. A very significant amount of money. And the settlement was 500 pages long, so I'm going to do my best to give you guys the Reader's Digest version.
Perfect. Thank you.
And you're welcome. So our reporter, Sydney Kidd, she put this together. The J.R. Simplot Company, they reached a settlement with the federal government over the environmental impacts of their fertilizer plant in Pocatello, the Dawn plant. And Simplot, they agreed to pay $1.5 million in civil penalties and nearly $150 million in waste management costs. The EPA, they're alleging that wastewater from the gypsum stack at the plant, which contains somewhat radioactive material, that it leaked into the soil and groundwater, eventually making its way into the Portneuf River. And according to the settlement, the EPA says that Simplot, they violated the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, the Clean Air Act, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, and the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. And as part of the $150 million waste management costs, Simplot, they're paying for environmental mitigation work, and that's supposed to address habitat degradation, invasive plant species, riverbank stabilization, sediment reduction, and the improvement of water quality in the Portneuf River. Simplot, they also provided a detailed 7-phase closure plan spanning 50 years. So when the company does decide to close the gypsum stacks inside the plant, that the public, they won't have to pay the price of that cleanup. And Simplot, they issued a statement which says in part that they're pleased to have worked with the EPA to reach this settlement.
Okay. So, Kevin, get us up to date on North Idaho College. So they are keeping their accreditation, but maybe it could go away again.
Well, yes, basically NIC got a reprieve last Friday from the regional accreditors. Even NIC is calling this a neutral decision, because what basically happened is they're not in the clear, but they will remain accredited for up to 12 more months. And what that means for students right away is students who are going to NIC, they can still get financial aid. They can still get like the Idaho Opportunity Scholarship. And if you're a student there, whether you're a student on campus or if you're a high school student taking a dual credit class through NIC, those classes, those credits are still transferable. Those are the big immediate impacts of maintaining the accreditation. But accreditors still want to see how NIC operates the next few months. They still obviously have questions. They still have a lot of things that they want to see the college do better in the next 12 months. And I outlined that in my story last Friday. They gave the college a pretty long list of items to address, including they want a clear sense of who's in charge up there. You know, this is a college that has gone through four presidents in 2 years and has a president, but has somebody they hired as an acting president who is still on the payroll but not serving as president. It's been a revolving door up there. So the accreditors still want to see some progress over these next few months. But for now, the college dodged a major bullet.
Okay, but Kevin, things didn't go as well in court for NIC recently.
Not for NIC, but this is a pretty significant court victory for for the Coeur d'Alene Press, the newspaper up there that's been doggedly covering the North Idaho saga the past few months. They took NIC to court. They sued NIC under the open records law, and they won. Basically, a judge sided with the newspaper and said NIC has to release employee contracts. Those are not confidential documents. Those are not personal records. And the judge called NIC out for releasing legal invoices in such a heavily redacted format that it prompted the Coeur d'Alene Press to file the lawsuit. So definitely a victory for the Coeur d'Alene Press and a setback for North Idaho College.
Yeah, definitely. So Will, talk to us about a plan to conserve land in the Mountain West, but it's getting some pushback. So it's called the public land rule. Can you tell us what that is? But then why are a lot of folks voicing concern about this?
Sure, absolutely. So the Bureau of Land Management, it's kind of the jack of all trades, I guess, land management organization within the United States Department of the Interior. Their goals often kind of run in contrast to each other. They're supposed to manage everything from mineral leasing to grazing interests to, of course, recreation and conservation. And so it's kind of amazing that I'm here talking about something with so much regional importance like this public lands role. And it's something that is so wonky and in the weeds. And yet we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who have already commented about this public lands rule. Essentially, what it would do is it would change the Bureau of Land Management's sort of internal rulemaking to elevate and prioritize conservation on the same level as mineral leasing, grazing, some of the other uses that I talk about in Idaho. Another one would be timber extraction. And what that would allow folks to do, if you're a conservation group who feels that, you know, some area by a river somewhere is really important to preserve for future generations, you could now lease that land for conservation, which is a pretty big change. It's not something that, you know, has happened before. And a lot of folks, particularly conservative interests in the Rocky Mountain West, so that includes folks from my state of Wyoming, but also folks from your state in Idaho, really feel that elevating conservation like this could put a damper on mining or grazing, you know, some of the industries that are really important for the Northern Rockies. And so it's something that the Bureau of Land Management is going to have to wade through, like I said, hundreds of thousands of public comments. We will see exactly what happens, but the Bureau of Land Management is not known for doing things quickly, so we might be talking about this for a long time.
I think you're probably right on that one. Clark, wildfire is upon us. Wildfire season, rather, is upon us. However, talk to us about what's going on in regards to seasonal firefighters, because what the state has said, they're having a really hard time finding experienced seasonal firefighters. So what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of high turnover, and it's difficult for them to retain experienced seasonal firefighters. And for this segment, we're talking about seasonal firefighters in particular that work for the state of Idaho, that work for the Idaho Department of Lands. The state has a full staff of 170 seasonal firefighters working for the state this year, but half of them are brand new. And so that means that the state has really struggled retaining experienced wildfire fighters. And I talked to Josh Harvey, who's the fire division chief for the Idaho Department of Land, about some of the reasons why that is and some of the challenges that presents to Idaho. But basically, he said, as a result of this turnover, we have fewer engine bosses, we have fewer incident managers, and we just don't have that experience in the field with our firefighters. And he said, in some cases, that can result in increased risks, that maybe veteran firefighters would recognize different risks more quickly than some of the brand new firefighters. And so he said that's one area of concern in particular. But there's all kinds of reasons why this is happening. Number one, it's a difficult and dangerous job, as we all know, serving on a hotshot crew or serving on a wildland firefighting crew is difficult, dangerous work. And the state increased the pay to about $15 an hour, but folks are saying that just isn't keeping up. If you drive around Boise or any town in Idaho right now, you're likely to see hiring signs at restaurants, grocery stores, retail stores that are right around that same $15 an hour window or even higher. And so they're having to compete with a lot of different industries and positions. The federal infrastructure law has allowed federal agencies to include some incentives and to offer more pay to their firefighters. And so the state is having to compete with their federal counterparts for hiring, but also the overall economy. And Idaho's housing costs are a factor in this. When I talked to Josh Harvey, he said, you know, traditionally, a certain segment of our seasonal firefighting crew is young students who are looking to save money up for the school semesters and bank that money fighting fires during the summer. But now he said, with the cost of housing, almost anywhere you look in Idaho having gone up considerably, certainly over the last 5 years, over the last 10 years as well, that a bigger chunk of that paycheck is going just to meet their housing needs. And so it doesn't make financial sense anymore for many students to have these summer jobs fighting fires when they are having to dump all their money into their housing costs and they aren't actually even able to save any money for when they return back to school. So there's all kinds of factors involved, involving the economy, involving inflation, involving housing, involving competition between different agencies. At the end of the day, he said that they're not going to be able to meet as high of a standard as the state had been able to meet in previous years. He said they still have full personnel, but it's inexperienced personnel. So they have enough people on the crews, they have enough people to fill the seats on the engine, but they don't have that veteran leadership. And that's one of the concerns that the state is facing right now, particularly in southern Idaho. It's been a slow start to the fire season where, as of yet, we haven't seen the number and size of the fires that we're used to. But fire officials are very concerned about some of the drying and drought conditions in North Idaho. And I know that anybody who's been outside this week and is making plans for this weekend is bracing for 100 degree plus temperatures across much of Idaho. And so the situation is changing. And they do expect that the fire danger and the fire risk is increasing in Idaho as we get farther away from that snow melt, as things continue to dry out, as temperatures heat up, and as we move into a dry summer season where we're going to have lightning, we're going to have people all throughout our mountains and public lands engaging in recreation activities. And so there's an extra level of concern right now among the state for a couple of different reasons, even though in Idaho so far we haven't seen the big fires. But I think, as most people know, Canada is facing a big dangerous year with their fire season, and there's some concerns right now in the state of Idaho. So they have full staff, but it's a lot of inexperienced firefighters at the state level who are out there. So something to keep in mind. And when I did write about it, I have some tips that the public can keep in mind to help prevent and reduce starting fires. As we know, as we continue to see each and every year, human-caused fires are one of the largest causes and a big factor that folks deal with every year. And when I spoke with Josh Harvey, he said the thing that he hears over and over and over again from people who accidentally start a fire is that they're just amazed by how quickly they start and how they spread so fast. Yeah. And so something to be on the lookout for, something to be aware of, and know that our risk is also likely to increase as the hot summer months continue on and we get some of those factors with drying conditions and drought and lightning and people out and about on our public lands. This is really the time where folks are really starting to pay attention to the fire risk.
So Gretchen, let's talk about home sales. Numbers came out for June and kind of a mixed bag at the Treasure Valley.
It is, yes. These are the latest numbers from the Intermountain Multiple Listing Service. And like you said, the latest available data for June, it shows in Ada County, the median price of a home sold rose again, coming in at $545,000. Now, this is the third month the median price in Ada County has gone up. It's the highest median price since August of last year. In Canyon County, a slightly different story. The median price fell, coming in at $405,000, and that's less than the median price this time a year ago. Inventory is slightly increasing. The number of homes available for sale on the last day of June, that was 2,106, which is up for the fourth month in a row. However, the inventory, it's still lower than June of last year when there were 3,326 houses on the market. Another stat is that 733 homes sold in Ada County in June. That's compared to 417 that closed Canyon County. And that's less in both counties this time a year ago. And then finally, homes, they were on the market for an average of 33 days in Ada County and 53 days in Canyon County.
Huh. Which, and, you know, back in the day wasn't a very long time, but it seems like a long time now compared to,
right.
to you know, yeah, yeah, when we look back a year or two ago. Thanks for those numbers, Gretchen. Okay, Kevin, let's talk about the Empowering Parents program. You've been on our program before talking about this. You've written about this a lot. This is where eligible families have gotten money where they can buy things for their student for school. But as you've noted before, so some of this stuff may not have been what they were supposed to buy, yet there are gray areas in the law. So what in the world is going on with this now?
I think the biggest thing that's going on right now that might affect parents down the road is states trying to figure out exactly where this money should go going forward. Where should this $30 million in micro grants go? A lot of the money in the past has gone towards laptops and computers and internet access and the like. So, you mm-hmm. know, families can, you know, so kids can work on their classwork at home. Now you're getting into this kind of gray area. And I covered a meeting in Twin Falls this week of a parents group that's trying to help make recommendations about how this program should go. Where does the money go from here? Should it go into buying backpacks for kids? Should it go into buying athletic uniforms? Should it go into ballet shoes or ballet classes or both or neither? So you've got this parents committee that's going to spend the next couple of months looking at those kind of questions and trying to figure out exactly what makes sense, what's an appropriate use of these grant dollars. And they'll make recommendations to the State Board of Education probably in about October. And then the board should have some sort of an idea of where the money should go in the future. And why this all really matters is, you know, like I said, this is now a fixture in state education policy. The legislature put $30 million into this program to keep it going into the next year. You know, opening the door for this to become a permanent program. So what's happening right now with this committee is really important because it will lay the groundwork for what parents can spend that money on in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Kevin, I only have about 2 minutes left, but I mean, part of this was, I think it's important for our listeners to understand is that no money ever was given to parents, right? They had to go online, which I would assume when you go online that these vendors have been vetted. And you could only purchase what would be allowable. And that was not the case.
Right. There have been concerns about what sort of information was given to parents and to the vendors about what is an allowable purchase or an unallowable purchase. And I've written about that quite a bit. And mm-hmm. I think part of the question going forward is what sort of access do parents have to vendors, especially when you get into rural Idaho? I think that was part of the discussion that we heard this week with the parents group. If you're a parent in rural Idaho and you can't buy items through a big box virtual retailer, Amazon had been a vendor in Empowering Parents for a while. They are no longer a vendor. If you're in a small town and there aren't many vendors available in your community where you can spend this money, you may kind of decide, well, shoot, I think they'll cover a backpack. A kid kind of needs a backpack. I may as well mm-hmm. spend some of my money on a backpack. So I think there's a lot of questions about what sort of access do parents have to services and products that really will help student achievement? And, you know, does a backpack fall into that gray area? You could debate about that. And that's kind of what the committee's talking about is, you know, what really helps students do better in school?
Yeah. Well, at least they're having these discussions finally, which maybe should have been
happening. It was a pretty thoughtful discussion. Got to say that.
So I want to thank everyone for taking time on your Friday to come in. A big thank you to our panelists, Kevin Richer, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with Boise Dev, and Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau and Wyoming Public Media. Thank you all so much. Happy Friday and have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.